This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, a show that provides you with up-to-date medical information, and we answer all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you on this sunny Saturday morning. When I mention the sun, it brings to mind our weather, which is a combination of heat and rain. As many of you know, we have been having a tremendous amount of heat and a heat wave throughout the southern states and the United States, and to the point where it has reached record levels. Every day, there's a new record. I mean, to the point where I was watching what's going on in Las Vegas, where the temperature of concrete there is 165 degrees. You know the old saying, it was so hot you could fry an egg on the sidewalk. We never thought that would be true, but it appears to be the case. And it's affected those who are unsheltered and people who don't have reliable shelter, who live on the street. And even if you fall down for a short period of time, people are appearing in emergency rooms with burns. And I think it's worthwhile for us to have a little bit of a discussion again on heat-related illnesses and how important it is for us to be aware of heat and how we're feeling, to be in touch with our bodies. I mean, the first of these illnesses is heat cramps, and it's just what it says. You start feeling muscle cramps, usually in larger muscles in your body, so things like your legs. And it's a sign that you need to get more fluid in. Basically, they're very painful cramps. You'll find that your skin is flushed, you're pale. You've got to get to a cool area and start taking in fluid. And I think we've all experienced those. It's relatively mild, but it's an early warning sign. If you miss that, and you say, well, I'm just going to keep going. I'm going to keep playing my sport. I'm going to keep riding my bike or running. It will lead to heat exhaustion. Now, this is clearly a more severe situation. Not only do you have the muscle cramps, but now you start running a fever. And you develop nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, headache. You really start feeling these symptoms where it forces you to stop what you're doing. And you are now bordering into emergent care. So what you need to do, again, is get to a cool space, take off excessive clothing, start drinking cool things. If you can, get into a cold shower, a cold swimming pool if there's one nearby. If it's a child and you start noticing these symptoms, they don't have a lot of reserve for heat illnesses, so you really need to get them to an emergency room or some medical facility. So all of these things become more crucial in children because, well, first of all, they don't have the wherewithal that we do in terms of being in touch with how we feel. Also, there's a lower body mass, right? And therefore, we have the situation where it becomes much more emergent. If it progresses on to what's best called is heat stroke, again, you have now your skin is not sweaty. It has become absolutely dry, hot. Usually a temp is over 104 degrees. Again, still nausea, vomiting, headaches, confusion, stuporous, and actually can lead to seizures and neurologic symptoms like coma. So you're into a really difficult place. And again, have to get to a cool place, call 911, ice bags. Like I said, even with heat exhaustion, get the ice bags on. You can't hurt yourself by cooling yourself at this point in time. In athletics, and especially during football season, as it's going to start beginning, right? We're going to start seeing all the workouts coming together in August. We now have ice baths on the sideline for those who are in practice or even during a game on a hot day. So basically, it's one of those big tubs that you see people mixing concrete in or other things. You get them at Home Depot. And there's big coolers with ice, just filled with ice. And I've seen this have to be used, and it is dramatic in how you can save someone just by getting them in there, getting their clothes off as much as you can, and get them in that ice to get their body temperature down. It's very dramatic in how that helps. And the reason I add that is because we need to make sure that if our children are playing for a team and are out there in this heat, we need to insist that this be available. Athletic trainers, certified athletic trainers, know this. It's their mantra to have the ice bath, especially here in Connecticut. Here in Connecticut, we have the advantage of having the Corey Stringer Institute at the University of Connecticut, where they do probably the highest level research in heat-related illness, all as a result of the death of Corey Stringer, a football player who died of a heat-related illness, and his family generously donated that institute. One of the other things you can do to really, first of all, avoid this is clothing. There are so many different types of clothing out there to try to keep you cool. One of the products that I've become familiar with and have purchased is Mission Heat is the company, and they make hats, they make various types of scarves, and what it does is it has a fabric that partially was developed here in Connecticut, and when you wet the fabric, you can wring it out, and it immediately cools you. It immediately provides a cooling. It doesn't have to be ice water, just any water activates it. And in fact, I own a hat with such a thing, so that if it's extremely hot, I could just pour some water or just any kind of water, get it on the hat, wring it out, put it on my head, and it immediately provides a means of cooling. Always have a lot of water handy. Cold water helps, right, to get that internal cooling. So really some tips in dealing with heat, especially if you're traveling. A lot of people are on the road going out west, may not be familiar with that type of heat. Their bodies may not be acclimated to that. So important to keep these things in mind. This day in medicine, July 15th in 1622, a charter was granted to the Royal Society of London. Now that has changed its name. It's become known as the Royal Society, and it is basically the National Academy of Sciences for the United Kingdom. And the reason I bring that up is because sometimes we hear these terms and are not exactly familiar with what they are. And basically, this Royal Society is an organization that goes out and recognizes and supports contributions to science. And it could be any form of science. But again, it emphasizes the need for good science, even from the 1600s, right, when this was established. We want to know what is good science. And much of what they do is not just in the United Kingdom, but they recognize science globally and help foster better science among young people. The importance here is because we are now faced with so many people who denied the existence of science. Hard to believe. I mean, if we have gone through the age of enlightenment, I have to tell you currently, we're not very enlightened. Many people do not act enlightened, right? They hear something on the internet and suddenly that's science. So we're dealing with this, and there are organizations out there that promote science. Many of you who listen to the show, I know I'm preaching to the choir because we understand. good science is something that could be put to the test and proven time and time again. And if it cannot be proven, it cannot be reproducible, it's not good science. So with that, we're getting ready to take a short break, and then we're going to be back at the bottom of the hour. We're going to have a few more things I want to talk about, but Dr. Anil McGee is going to be my guest. He's been a guest on our program before. He's a pulmonologist from Trinity Health of New England, and we're going to talk about new treatment for COPD, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and emphysema. And it's a device that he works with at St. Francis Hospital. So I really am looking forward to our conversation with him. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony
Lessie. You can take the moon.
And as we are into the midst of summer, and we have a lot of rain that we've been facing as well, we're seeing a rise in tick-borne illnesses. And specifically here in Connecticut, we deal with Lyme disease, babesiosis, and the combination of ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis. So I thought it was worthwhile for us to review those to some extent. Now, many of you are already familiar with Lyme disease, right? All of these are tick-borne. In the case of Lyme disease, it's a bacteria, the Borrelia bacteria, and you get bitten, and often you'll have a signature rash, the erythema migrans, the so-called bullseye rash. And that's actually where the bacteria are growing. The bacteria then spread in the blood supply. The importance is early treatment. Early treatment with an antibiotic called doxycycline. If you're allergic to it, there are other antibiotics. But the key here is early treatment to get it in an early stage. The more severe symptoms in later stages you're going to see are severe joint pain, fatigue, kind of a chronic viral syndrome of just weakness. And it's such a treatable problem that many people have advocated for the use of antibiotics early. So what would happen typically is if you've been bitten by a tick, a deer tick specifically, and you know it, you take the tick off of you. Many people advocate for treating with doxycycline. And even if it's just one dose of 100 milligrams, you could potentially stop the possibility of getting Lyme disease. Otherwise, you're going to sit back for about a week to see if the symptoms develop. And often by then now, it's going to take a much longer period of 30 days of antibiotic. So that's one approach to Lyme disease. There's also people who suffer from chronic symptoms of Lyme disease. It's not because the bacteria is still alive in those people. It's much like post-COVID. It's much like chronic fatigue syndrome. It goes by a lot of different names. And you may associate it with one illness or another, but there are still these chronic symptoms of fatigue, achiness, and weakness. So we're always on the lookout for Lyme disease, which is the most common of these. But I've heard of several cases recently of babesiosis. Again, it's a tick-borne illness, but this is a parasitic disease, right? So the difference between a parasite and a bacteria is the fact that the parasite cannot live on its own. So what this parasite does is it attaches to red blood cells. And in doing so, it lives off of the red blood cell and destroys that red blood cell. What it can lead to is something called hemolytic anemia. So basically, the red blood cells become destroyed faster than your body can produce them, right, in your spleen and bone marrow, making you anemic and severely weak. Again, similar symptoms, this generalized weakness, fatigue, wanting to sleep all the time, fever in many cases, right? Sounds like COVID. So there's this big overlap. But again, in this case, you are bitten by a tick. It can also lead to more symptoms in terms of, don't forget, your red blood cells produced in the spleen. Spleen starts to get large and swell. It could be very severe. The treatment is different, though, because you have to use antiparasitic drugs, and there are a variety of those that are used for this. But they also treat with an antibiotic. So it's a very different approach, and in many cases leads to hospitalization, a brief hospitalization, as in the cases I've heard of recently. So again, we need to be alert to that. And the final are really two that run together, ehrlichiosis and anaplasmosis. These are, again, bacteria-related. Again, different. They are different organisms from the ticks themselves, but lead to anemia, can lead to low white blood cell counts. You'll see fever, headache, muscle cramps, as we discussed. But in all of these, you can see neurologic symptoms. And that's when things become so much more severe. Those neurologic symptoms being, starting with a headache, a severe headache that persists over a period of time. Often they will get meningitic symptoms, neck pain. They can't really bend their neck forward. So you develop a meningitis from these. Confusion, seizures, epileptic events. And these are obviously emergent and can have long-standing problems. How do we prevent it? Let's go over it. People in Connecticut know this, but we need to go over it. Again, using various sprays, creams, whatever, that repel ticks is important. Clothing. Wearing long sleeves, long pants. If you're out there and there's brush, right, some long grass, you see that on golf courses all the time. We see this in golfers all the time because they can't just leave the ball in that thick grass. And they're going to go after that golf ball no matter what and often come out with tick bites when they're wearing shorts and short sleeves. So long sleeves, long pants if you're going out hiking, especially in the fall and during wet seasons such as this. And look at your property. Do you have places where ticks and mosquitoes can go on? These puddles, right? Just puddles that exist for a long period of time, damp leaves that are sitting out there. That's where these organisms really thrive. So with that, I think it's important that we are aware of this. Another summertime thing I wanted to get on was pickleball. Many of you have now heard of it. It is a very fast-growing sport, especially among the older population. It's kind of a cross between tennis and ping pong, really. The court's about one-third the size of a tennis court, usually played in doubles. And there are about 36 million Americans have played this in a recent study. 36 million Americans have played this at least once in 2022. And there are a core group of players who play at least eight times a year. And so we're looking at a lot of people playing this, usually an older population. What we've also seen is a growth in the number of injuries related to this. Approximately in 2022, 67,000 emergency room visits in addition to outpatient visits. Why? Well, it's an activity. It's a sport, and it's inclined for older athletes. So with that, you have the possibility of sprained ankle, tripping and falling on the court, and it leads to those illnesses. Now, you're probably saying, wait a second, what's this guy coming up with? He always tells us to be more active, and now talking about these illnesses. I'm really just talking about these acute injuries that you'll see in any sport. There are a lot of advantages to this sport. And I talk to a lot of patients who play it and talk to them. One is the social aspect. It's not highly competitive. I guess it could be highly competitive. I mean, tiddlywinks could be highly competitive. But most people are out there to just get some activity and socialize. It's a very social game. The games are fast. So you're not out there for hours doing this. They go to 11 points and it's pretty quick. And don't forget, one of the things our Surgeon General has talked about is the problem of loneliness. It's an epidemic in this country. People have gone to themselves. They live their lives on the internet and not getting outside and mixing with others. So we've talked about this before on the program, getting into an activity that you could do with a lot of people. There are courts. Many communities have now put courts in, and it's extremely popular. So despite the fact that there's an increase in these injuries, these injuries that are recorded are relatively minor, and the benefit outweighs the risk to get out there and do a sport where you're socially involved. With that, we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Anil McGee. He's a pulmonologist, and we're going to be talking about COPD and emphysema. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi. And today it gives me great pleasure to welcome back Dr. Anil McGee. Dr. McGee is a pulmonologist specializing in interventional pulmonology. He was a guest on our program previously back in January. He works at Trinity Health of New England, and his specialty, in addition to interventional pulmonology, is pulmonary and critical care medicine. Anil, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Dr. Alessi. Thank you for having me back. It's always a pleasure.
It's great having you. Let's talk a little bit. So before we get into COPD and emphysema, can you talk a little bit about the basic physiology of how the lungs work and how COPD and emphysema affect that?
Sure. It all comes down to oxygen and carbon dioxide exchange. Typically, COPD is a result of smoking, particularly in the United States. And what happens with smoking is that the particles damage the air sacs, which make up the lung tissue, and that's where gas exchange occurs. So that's where your oxygen will replace the carbon dioxide when you inhale, and then when you exhale, you get rid of the carbon dioxide. So what happens when you smoke and you have emphysema, that can't happen. So patients tend to be very short of breath or require oxygen. And that's the main issue at play when patients have advanced COPD, that they have troubles with their breathing.
What's the difference between COPD and emphysema? Is that the old, I always remember the blue bloater and the pink puffer. Is that where it comes in, or are they synonymous?
They're similar. So COPD, formerly called chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, is usually sort of the mother term. So it refers to a group of diseases that really cause trouble with airflow and results in breathing issues. So this can either be emphysema that really affects these air sacs, or what we call alveoli, which makes up the lung tissue where the gas exchange occurs, or also chronic bronchitis, which really affects the airways. So I often liken the lung to a tree where you have your trunk and branches, and then you have your leaves. Very similarly of how the lung is made up. The trunk and branches are your main airways, which then lead to the lung tissue, which is the leaves on a tree.
How big a problem is this? Now, you talked about smoking, and yet we know that cigarette smoking, at least, has gone down, I mean, dramatically in the past 30 or 40 years. Are there other illnesses, autoimmune illnesses, things like that might cause COPD and emphysema?
Yes, there are other contributors to COPD, but still by far the main problem here in the United States is smoking. And even though there has been a dramatic decrease in smoking in the United States, at one point it was as high as 21% back in the early 2000s. The most recent data from 2021 shows that still about 12% of the U.S. population currently smokes. And that's just what we're talking about, cigarettes. Now with legalization of marijuana sort of across the country and here in Connecticut, that may be that may also contribute to COPD in the future. Other things such as air pollution, air quality, as we just here in Connecticut sort of dealt with from the forest fires that were happening in Canada and the terrible air quality that we've been having here can contribute to it. And then outside of that, you can have some genetic predispositions to COPD. That's much rarer. Outside the United States, we talk about biomass fuel and cooking, and patients from outside the U.S. typically do that in homes, so there's significant exposure to that. So there are multiple contributors to COPD, but smoking still is the biggest issue.
You know, I think you raised a couple of really good points there. You know, a lot of times now with the legalization of marijuana, people think, well, it's all natural. It can't really hurt you, but it's still smoking, and there are still plenty of toxins in whatever it is you're buying. So I think people fail to recognize that, and I'm glad you brought up the environmental causes that we all face, and some people more vulnerable than others. So the way I understand it is we have COPD, and emphysema is a subpopulation of a more severe problem because it affects the lungs more distally or further out on the tree branches. Am I correct?
You got it. And it really affects the air sacs that are involved with oxygen carbon dioxide exchange. So when this gets damaged, you don't have proper transfer of oxygen into the body, and patients become short of breath and have low oxygen levels, and that causes a lot of distress for the patient and can have a lot of stress on the other parts of the body, such as the heart.
So how do you treat it? I mean, we always see people now, and more we see people getting out with portable oxygen, right? And so we see that all the time. But other than oxygen supplementation, what can be done for these folks?
Sure. The first and the one I want to focus on the most is patients got to quit smoking. It's really adding fuel to the fire. Even if we try to give medications or other treatments, smoking and using oxygen is very, very dangerous. It's combustible. So there's issues with that. So quitting smoking, I would say, is the number one thing. And I think we make good strides on that as we see the decline in the number of U.S. citizens smoking. Number two, try to avoid air pollutants as much as possible. So if it's poor air quality, try not to go outside when that is. Or if you know you're going to an area of the world that has more pollution, using a mask. Other things that we sometimes take for granted, proper nutrition, exercise, and I can't emphasize that enough. Patients that have strong muscles of the chest with help with breathing feel a lot better. And there's a lot of literature to support pulmonary rehab, which we often refer patients that have COPD, who they tend to be a little bit weaker, to pulmonary rehab to get stronger. And then the fourth option we have is medications. We have a lot of good inhalers that are available that affects different receptors in the airway to really open them up. And besides oxygen medications, which are these inhalers, there's no really other good treatment solutions that we had until the past couple of years. The other ways we treat are with vaccinations, so trying to prevent any respiratory infections. So now with COVID, getting the COVID vaccine, but also the influenza, the pneumonia vaccine, we need to look to help our patients with advanced COPD protect themselves as they're being exposed more to various viruses or infections. And then lastly, as you hinted, having oxygen available. And this does help a lot of patients, but a lot of patients don't want to wear oxygen, which can cause too many issues. I had a patient the other day saying that they went to the grocery store and was embarrassed to wear oxygen and had to call the ambulance because he needed the oxygen and didn't have it with him. So oxygen is very important in treating patients with advanced COPD, but there are newer therapies available that we'll be talking about soon, which can make a tremendous impact on patients with advanced COPD and emphysema. Other options which are much more invasive is surgically removing part of the lung that has a lot of emphysema. That's been done. There's a lot of literature showing that there's a lot of risk associated with this in regards to the surgical procedure. And also sort of the most severe way to treat patients with advanced COPD and emphysema is a lung transplant. But patients that are transplanted tend not to have a long survival after being transplanted because they're at risk for many infections because they have to be immunosuppressed after being transplanted. So the treatment options haven't been ideal. However, we do have newer treatments such as bronchoscopic lung volume reduction, which we're doing here at St. Francis, and other places in Connecticut are doing as well, which can make a tremendous impact.
Anil, how does doing a pneumonectomy, so removing part of the lung, how does that help the situation?
Emphysema usually affects parts of the lung. Typically, it's the upper lobes of the lung. So if you think about smoke rises to the top, typically we see a lot of effects from smoking to the tops of the lung. So sometimes in the past where we would do surgical removal of the part of the lung that was not working. So the areas that had the most amount of emphysema, they would surgically resect it out. Typically not a pneumonectomy, but usually a part of the lung or a wedge resection that where majority of the emphysema was, they would take it out. However, there tended to be a lot of complications post-procedure.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, patients would get pneumonia. There would be something called a persistent air leak. So the tissue's not healthy, and when the surgeon sews it up, there's going to be small leaks, which can cause a lot of issues. And they found that patients actually could die at about 3% rate 3 months out from the surgery. So this is a procedure that people have sort of shied away from. And the fact that we can now do something minimally invasive like bronchoscopic lung volume reduction can help a lot of patients.
I don't want to digress, but you mentioned vaccines. The RSV vaccine, are you using that in patients, the respiratory syncytial virus vaccine in patients now or getting ready to use it in the fall? Is that going to be effective?
I think so. I think we're going to be getting ready to use it. I have not used it yet, but I think time will come for it. As we saw a lot of patients with RSV ending up in the hospital. So any way to prevent this from happening is a great thing.
All right. What I really want to talk about is this Zephyr procedure and this valve that you can use to improve care for people with COPD and emphysema. Can you explain that to us?
Sure. So the Zephyr valve is a one-way valve. It's made out of silicone and nickel titanium metal. They're very small. And what you do is you put these valves in to block off areas of the lung that's most affected by emphysema. So I recently did this procedure on a patient that had the majority of the emphysema in the lower portion of the left lung. So in order to divert the oxygen to the better parts of the lung, you put in these one-way valves that will allow air to come out, but no air to go in. So basically closes down that part of the lung that has the most emphysema, and that area of lung is not really participating in gas exchange. So by diverting the oxygen to the better parts of the lung, patients can feel better. So there are small valves I put bronchoscopically. It's done under general anesthesia. There's a tube helping patients breathe for the procedure. The procedure takes me about 20 to 30 minutes to do. And through a bronchoscope, it has a working channel where I can deploy these valves through under direct visualization to the segments of the lobe. The left lung has two lobes. The right side has three lobes. However, we do a lot of work prior to the procedure, making sure that the patient's a good candidate for the procedure, because there is risk involved in putting these valves in.
So what have your results been like?
They've actually been tremendous. There was a recent article published in the Hartford Current talking about one of my patients who did extremely well. And this patient was an older gentleman, about 70, 75. He was diagnosed with COPD emphysema about 6 years back, and he was being medically managed, meaning he was on inhalers, he was on oxygen therapy, and he wasn't doing well. He would get hospitalized quite frequently for COPD exacerbations, requiring steroids and other inhalers, antibiotics. He would get infections quite a bit.
Was he using and supplemental oxygen too?
Correct, and he was on supplemental oxygen.
Wow.
So his general pulmonologist, after talking with him, and because there were no better options, he referred the patient to myself for evaluation of this procedure. Before we do the procedure, we make sure that the patient's a good candidate, because of the risk of doing the procedure, we want to make sure that they're going to get the most benefit. So we don't do the procedure if they're not going to get any benefit from the procedure. And the way we do that is we get several tests, including a CAT scan, which gets more detail of the chest by various pictures. We get breathing tests to see how if they fit criteria based on certain numbers of that test for these valves. We get an ultrasound of the heart to see if the heart's good and make sure we're not putting any stress on the heart when we do this procedure. And then we also want to make sure that the perfusion to that lung where we're going to close off is low, meaning we don't want a lot of blood flow to that area because that can also result in waste of oxygen. So there are a lot of tests that we do prior to this procedure to ensure that the patient would receive benefit from the procedure. And once we deem the patient's a good candidate, then we take them to the OR to do this procedure. And when we close down an area of the lung, so for my patient, we close down the bottom portion of the left lung, what happens is the upper portion of the left lung will try to compensate to fill that area. And when that happens, you can get a tear in the lung. So that's why we take it pretty serious to make sure a patient's a good candidate, because there are risks involved with doing the procedure. And because of these risks, we do admit the patient to the hospital for 3 days. Because with various studies, they've showed that the highest risk for what we call a pneumothorax or a tear in the lung happens within the first 72 hours. So if we need to put a chest tube to remove that air after the lung tears, we can do that immediately. Also, we watch these patients to make sure that they don't develop COPD exacerbations requiring steroids or pneumonias where they require antibiotics. So after the procedure is done, they get admitted to the hospital for 3 days at least. And if they do well, then they go home. Then afterwards, we get a CAT scan, usually within a month, to make sure that the valves worked. We did close down that area of the lung. And also to get repeat breathing tests to see quantitatively, did they improve. And then most importantly, we base it on patient symptoms, if they're feeling better. So this patient did extremely well. He was able to garden again. He can able to go. He was able to go for walks, things that he was not able to do for several years because he was so limited by the COPD and emphysema. He came off oxygen. We still keep patients on the inhalers to maximize their lung function, but he was able to come off oxygen.
I know this is amazing. So basically, you're diverting oxygen from the diseased tissue to healthier tissue in the lung to make the lungs more efficient.
That's exactly right.
Wow. This is tremendous. If someone's interested, listeners are interested in this, how would they best reach out to you to get a consultation and see if they are appropriate for this procedure?
Yeah, I think the first thing is to reach out to their primary care physician and say, I have COPD, as you know. I have emphysema, as you know. Can you refer me to a pulmonologist to see if I'm a candidate for bronchoscopic lung volume reduction or for these valve treatments? In order to get a hold of me, they can just call St. Francis Hospital and coordinate a visit with me. And I can leave my information at the end. But I think reaching out to their primary care physician first, or often these patients already have pulmonologists who are aware of this procedure, reaching out to them and saying, am I a candidate? And if they are, I think they would make the referral, whether it's to me or other interventional pulmonologists in the state of Connecticut, to see if they can qualify and have the procedure done.
Anil, thank you for your time, and thanks for taking time today to explain this exciting procedure. It's been educational for me, and I'm sure for many of our listeners. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Leslie. I appreciate it.
Take care. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back to wrap things up. We're back on Healthy Rounds, and we're wrapping up another show. It's been great to have my guest, Dr. Anil McGee, with me today. Many thanks to our studio producer. Kevin Kors has been on the board. Jeff Chandler is in charge of sales and marketing for Healthy Rounds. I'm going to be away for the next several shows. Here's what we did. We put together new shows for everybody. With bringing back some interviews that we've done in the past, but each show has new information in the first half of the program so we can keep everybody up to date. And then we're going to be back with live programming in August. So with that, I want to thank all of our listeners and thank everybody who helped us put that together. Next up on WTIC is going to be Law Talk with Attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi. Sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.